The headlines: projections suggest that Republicans will take control of the U.S. House of Representatives as vote counting continues. One more Palestinian teenager is killed by Israeli forces during a raid on the city of Nablus. And South Korea says its neighboring North has fired a ballistic missile off its east coast as tensions mount on the Korean Peninsula. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisu Mishahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. We're beginning this bulletin with the latest on the U.S. midterm elections. The future of Congress hangs in the balance, as it is still unclear whether Democrats will be able to keep their majority in both the Senate and the House. No party is currently holding the lead in the Senate. There are 100 seats up for grabs, and people are waiting on the fate of only four of them. In the U.S. House, Republicans have been able to secure more seats than Democrats, despite many votes having yet to come in. House Republican-elect Kevin McCarthy says it is clear that Republicans will take control of the House. There are 435 seats up for grabs in that chamber. A shift in power in Congress would make Democratic President Joe Biden a lame duck for his remaining 2 years in office.
From the insurrection in the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, to block the certification of the presidential election results to the October 28 attack on U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home, these incidents are among the most high-profile instances of political violence in America in recent times. Now, many believe the problem has gone from bad to worse in recent weeks. Harassment of political candidates and voter intimidation have been reported in many parts of the country, prompting some local authorities to elevate vigilance on Election Day. Also, threats against members of Congress are up tenfold. According to Capitol Police, more than 9,600 threats against members of Congress were recorded last year. Threats against federal judges have sparked 400% in the past 6 years to more than 4,200 in 2021. Also, election poll workers have received hundreds of violent threats, leading many to resign from their positions and discouraging others from volunteering in first place. Analysts believe the current trend of increased threats to lawmakers and election officials, extremist candidates running for office, disinformation and heated rhetoric are raising the risk of domestic terrorism and other forms of extreme violence in the United States. That's why a new survey suggests that almost 1 in 5 Americans agree that violence is sometimes needed to protect democracy when elected leaders will not. Therefore, U.S. politics is now in danger of spilling over into street violence. As an answer to unwanted results, nearly 9 in 10 Americans are concerned that political divisions have intensified to the point that there is a risk of politically motivated violence in the United States, and the 2022 midterm elections could act as a catalyst for future domestic extremist violence in the U.S.
Biden's comments ahead of elections have reflected a deep political divide in the United States that could see Republicans win the control of both chambers of Congress. A shift in power on the Capitol Hill would make the Democratic president a lame duck for his remaining 2 years in office.
U.S. President Joe Biden has sounded the alarm over threats to democracy in his closing arguments ahead of the midterm elections.
Democracy is on the ballot. Political violence and intimidation are on the rise all across America. And you remember January 6th, the angry mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol, attacked law enforcement, hunted down elected officials, erected gallows to hang Vice President Pence. Well, West's opponent supported that mob. Who the hell do they think they are?
Biden has called on Americans to accept the election results and avoid resorting to violence. Also, former U.S. President Donald Trump said he's expecting a Republican victory in the elections. Trump has also vowed to make a big announcement next week, hinting that he's going to run for the 2024 presidential election.
This is the year we're going to take back the House, we're going to take back the Senate, and we're going to take back America. And in 2024, most importantly, we are going to take back our magnificent wife. I'm going to be making a very big announcement on Tuesday, November 15th, at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida.
The 2022 midterm elections are the first vote since the January 6th Capitol riot. Democrats have been campaigning around what they call the threat a Republican win would pose to U.S. democracy. Republicans, however, have focused their campaign on such issues as soaring inflation and the scale of violent crimes. Dozens of Republican candidates who could be elected as governors or elected administrators in key states have also echoed Trump's claims of fraud in his 2020 presidential election defeat. Election forecasters predicted that Republicans are likely to pick up roughly 25 seats in the 435-seat House of Representatives, more than enough to win a majority.
Russia says its ties with Washington will remain at rock bottom regardless of the outcome of the U.S. midterm elections. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov described the existing relations with the U.S. as bad and said that the elections would not have any significant impact. Moscow's relations with Washington are currently at a historic low over the conflict in Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly slammed the White House for providing Kiev with weapons and financial support, a move that could be considered if Republicans came take control of Congress. The U.S. has committed multiple security packages to Ukraine and slapped numerous sanctions on Russia since the beginning of the war in February. Earlier this week, Kiev urged Washington to remain united until there was a peace in Ukraine. Israeli forces carry out a new attack in the occupied West Bank, killing one Palestinian man in the city of Nablus. Israeli forces shot dead 18-year-old Mahdi Mohammad Hasha during an early morning raid. Three other Palestinians were seriously injured and taken to hospital. Israel has recently tightened its deadly grip on the occupied West Bank and widened its crackdown on Palestinians there. More than 140 people have lost their lives in the West Bank this year alone. Palestinians have repeatedly called on the international community to help end the Israeli blitz in the occupied territories. Our correspondent Muna Kendall has joined us to tell us what exactly happened in the city. Let's take a listen.
About over 50 Palestinians suffered suffocation due to inhaling tear gas, according to Palestinian paramedics. What happened is that Israeli settlers and Israeli Knesset members raided the Joseph Tomb in Nablus. It's adjacent to Balata refugee camp. And their Palestinian fighters opened fire at the convoy, according to the Israeli military, and attacked those settlers who were raiding the Joseph Tomb. Immediately, the Israeli forces who were accompanying the settlers and the Israeli Knesset members from the Likud party raided Balata refugee camp, raided several areas also around the Joseph Tomb, and killed this Palestinian young man, wounded three others, and carried out arrests among the Palestinians. Today, in the occupied West Bank, over 15 Palestinians were detained by the Israeli soldiers. According to a statement by the Israeli military, those who were detained are accused for wanted security reasons, are members of the different Palestinian resistance groups, and had been taking in different forms of resistance against the Israeli settlers and the Israeli forces.
Reports coming out of Iraq and Syria border say that two tankers carrying fuel have come under attack. At least four explosions reportedly rocked the Qaim border crossing early on Wednesday. Iraqi media have quoted intelligence sources as saying that the tankers were carrying Iranian fuel to Lebanon, adding that the explosions left no casualties. Some local sources say the attack was a drone strike. An Iraqi source speaking on condition of anonymity said the attack had been carried out by the Israeli regime. Peter Ford is a former British ambassador to Syria. He explains how the attack at the Iraqi-Syria border is meant as a provocation to escalate regional tensions.
Possible candidates for being the attackers are not just Israel, but also the United States. Perhaps Israel has a strong motive at the moment because some elements in Israel would like to sabotage the talks between the United States and Iran on reviving the nuclear deal. So some in Israel, and especially perhaps now that Netanyahu is back in power in that country, would see advantage in creating a provocation designed to bring about an escalation with Iran, a provocation to bring about a state close to war with Iran. On the other hand, the United States also has sufficient motive. For years, they have been trying to sabotage cooperation between Iran and regional countries, especially Syria and Lebanon. Lebanon, at the moment, is suffering greatly, especially as a result of sanctions against Syria, Iran, and Lebanon itself.
Iran warns the UK of consequences over its attempts to destabilize the Islamic Republic during the recent riots across the country. Intelligence Minister Ismail Khatib says, unlike the UK, Iran will never support terrorist acts in other countries. But at the same time, he added that Iran will have no obligation to prevent the emergence of insecurity in those countries. Therefore, the minister said that the UK will pay for its actions to make Iran insecure. Khatib spoke about a London-based Persian language TV network, Iran International. He said that Tehran has declared the channel a terrorist organization whose agents will be prosecuted by the intelligence ministry. Khatib said Saudi Arabia and Israel were also involved in actions supporting the riots in Iran. Unrest broke out following the death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini. Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton has talked about the recent riots in Iran, saying, quote, protesters were armed with weapons smuggled from the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Bolton made the remarks in an interview with a BBC Persian TV channel. He characterized the rioters as opposition and said that he had seen images of some protesters being trained and armed in Iraq's Kurdistan region. Earlier, Iran's Border Guard Command announced the seizure of over 5,000 pieces of U.S.-made cold weapons at the borders. The commander of a border force, General Ahmad Ali Gudarzi, said over 600 firearms, including pistols and rifles, were also discovered and seized over the past 45 days. Sayed Mohammad Marandi is a professor at the University of Tehran. He says the terrorist groups themselves have admitted to having an active role in the recent riots in Iran.
They admit openly, or they claim that they are active inside Iran, and they claim to be leading the riots. So there's no surprise when people are seen, photos are taken, footage is taken of people using knives, slitting police officers by the throat, shooting and killing other police officers and Besiege members, burning people alive, and then simultaneously being glorified in Western countries and in the Western media as freedom fighters, and Persian language media based in London calling their acts of murder, of burning people alive, of brutality against the police as legitimate. And if these media outlets were in English, Ofcom would, and they were directed towards an English audience or an English country or British English-speaking country, Ofcom would shut these television stations down immediately and put these people on trial.
North Korea has once again test fired a ballistic missile amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea's military says the North fired the missile off its east coast. Japan's Coast Guard also confirmed the launch. Over the past several days, North Korea has fired a barrage of missiles in response to the largest ever war games by Washington and Seoul. Pyongyang considers the military exercises as a rehearsal for an invasion. Washington and Seoul, however, say that they are holding the drills because the North is about to resume testing of nuclear bombs for the first time since 2017. Frank Smith, our correspondent in Seoul, says Pyongyang is sending a message to the U.S. and South Korea that it will continue developing its nuclear missile capabilities.
Now you have a new president here in South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, and he's vowed to take a hard line with North Korea over its missile testing, which it really sort of ramped up this year with something like 30-odd tests just in the past week, last week, and then from the beginning of the year, 50 tests. Yoon Suk-yeol just came to power here in the South in May, and so I think this is partly a message to the Yoon Suk-yeol administration from North Korea that it's going to continue with its missile and nuclear development, and also a message to the United States. It's kind of doing like strategic patience 2.0. That was the Obama policy of really kind of ignoring North Korea. What we saw during that period was a lot of missile testing and some nuclear testing, and seeing North Korea really develop its capabilities here. At the same time, here in South Korea, with the South Korea-U.S. alliance, President Yoon Suk-yeol has wanted to strengthen that alliance, and that's what you see with these recent drills. Drills that began in late August that were land-based drills for the first time in 5 years, the largest in 5 years, and then with the recent Air Force drills, the so-called Vigilant Storm drills that took place and ended Saturday.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Joe Biden has asked oil companies to increase supply and lower prices at their own expense, while threatening them with higher taxes. But will it help the Democrats' election chances? Stay tuned for more. In this regard, RT provided an op-ed to shed more light on this issue, writing, "In direct opposition to the Democratic Party's green agenda, U.S. President Joe Biden has ordered the oil industry to ramp up production and lower prices or else. But does the U.S. leader have the power to control the free market? As public sentiment over the U.S. economy begins to boil, Biden is attempting to shift the blame onto the oil industry for hoarding profits while keeping prices at the pumps excessively high, thereby strangling economic growth. It's time for these companies to stop war profiteering, meet their responsibilities in this country, and give the American people a break and still do very well," Biden told reporters in the White House this week, adding, "If they don't, they're going to pay a higher tax on their excess profits and face higher restrictions." The U.S. leader said he would work with Congress to look at these options that are available to us and others. It's questionable, however, how the Democrats will be able to build bipartisan consensus for such penalties against the oil industry when the Republicans, who stand a good chance of winning the House come November 8, are openly hostile to any new stifling taxes. Although gas prices in the U.S. have decreased by $1.25 per gallon from a summer peak, the current national average is $3.76 per gallon, which is still more than 35 cents higher than this time last year. At a time when inflation has gone through the roof for everything from food to utilities, those extra pennies make a difference. Meanwhile, the oil industry, which continues to post astronomical profits, rejects Biden's claims that the American people are being left out of the bonanza. The CEO of ExxonMobil Corp, Darren Woods, said his company is dividing profits among shareholders. Woods told Bloomberg News, "There has been discussion in the U.S. about our industry retaining some of our profits directly to the American people. That's exactly what we're doing in the form of our quarterly dividend." The White House fired back on Twitter several hours later, saying, "Can't believe I have to say this, but giving profits to shareholders is not the same as bringing prices down for American families." Biden mentioned something in his White House speech that reflects his administration's short-sighted expectations of the oil industry at a time when the Democrats are attempting to enforce its green agenda on the American people. "Record profits today are not because they are doing something new or innovative. The profits are a windfall of war," Biden said in reference to the crisis now raging between Russia and Ukraine. The question many observers are asking is, why didn't the White House wait until those new and innovative technologies were online before canceling everything in one throw? While the Democrats blame Russia, Big Oil, and OPEC for America's current economic woes, on his first day in office, President Biden shut down oil and gas exploration in the Arctic National Wildfire Refuge, prohibited drilling in the state of Utah, and canceled the Keystone XL pipeline between the United States and Canada, Donald Trump's signature project that would have already largely reduced American dependency on oil supplies from the volatile West Asia region and beyond. Canadian oil would have flowed into the United States as freely as other things on top. To top it off, Biden announced in March a ban on Russian oil and other energy imports in retaliation for Moscow. Did he really think energy prices would stay put after those moves? Instead of waiting until the U.S. economy had made a full transition to renewable energy, the Democrats severed the country from its very lifeline. This has put the United States at the complete mercy of big oil, which is behaving with all the rapaciousness to be expected in a country built on the capitalist ethos. As long as the oil industry keeps shareholders happy, they can argue they are spreading the wealth, despite the fact that those investors who are now reaping a windfall make up a tiny percentage of the U.S. population and contribute little to economic growth overall. And now Biden and the Democratic Party find themselves scrambling to clean up a mess of their own making, with green crusaders screaming for windmills, solar power, and electric cars. The White House has been forced to take 180 million barrels from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, SPR, now drained to its lowest level since 1984, while asking the oil industry to increase supply and reduce prices. Yet Biden may ultimately find himself snubbed by big oil, as much he was by America's Persian Gulf allies, particularly Saudi Arabia, when he asked them to increase oil production. While it may seem an honorable undertaking for the United States to wean itself from a planet-killing oil addiction, to do so without a backup plan is simply economic and political suicide.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood. And currently we are focusing mostly on the first and second sermon of Nahjul Balagha, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains about the circumstances that were present at the time of the coming of the messengers and prophets. And we shared a reminiscence with the present day era, where we see that the same issues that were occurring before the coming of the messengers, today also we see those same circumstances coming. And therefore, we are also in need of guidance, just like the times of the previous generations were in need of that guidance. And of course, our situation is different because the final messenger has already come. So in the absence of these messengers, how do we get that guidance? The most important thing is to receive that guidance. About that guidance, inshallah, I will come and explain about that very soon. But for now, The important thing is to understand those circumstances in which we were as human beings at the time of the coming of the messengers, and also compare it with the situation of today, and we see that similarity is there, especially the aspect of confusion, the aspect of different, you know, human beings, everyone having a different idea about reality, and that idea about reality actually influencing the way they act in life, and then leading to that disunity that we see that there is today. Inshallah, when we come back, we're going to discuss more about this.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when we talk about this issue of confusion, we say that many of the communities and many of the countries of the world, many people of the world, many nations, they were in this state. They started to struggle and fight against the colonial authorities, but then the colonial powers, they decided to change their tactics, and they used a softer approach, which meant that they would aim at the minds and the hearts and the souls of the people, and not forcefully and coercingly try and control people's lands. And this was a very, very accepted, very, very much, you can say, a fulfilled plan by them. So they had so many independent countries of the world, but are truly just dependent countries, unfortunately, because of that cultural war, that cultural influence of some of the Western countries on these various nations. And therefore, from these nations, we find a few nations that were able to have steadfastness against this cultural invasion. And one of them was, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which came up with a new system, in fact, a system that was quite strong, that could challenge the systems that exist in the world today. And that was the system of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Islamic Revolution. And this revolution is based on very firm fundamental principles, and it is something that is going to be able to challenge properly the cultural invasion that the West is trying to wage on different countries of the world. The only thing is that is to realize that before the Islamic Revolution, Iran faced quite similar circumstances. A large group of the people, you'd notice, did not have that, you know, you can say that insight and that awareness and that astuteness with regards to political issues. And they were culturally influenced by the West and the Western hegemonic powers. And therefore, the country was quite malleable under the hands of the hegemonic powers. So they needed something to remove this hegemony, and that was the revolution.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when the revolution happened, it came up with an apparatus that truly was, you can say, revolutionary in its essence. It didn't accept elements of the Western society into itself. On the one hand, it was on the one hand, it was able to quite, deftly control the environment in such a way that some of the positive aspects of the Western academia and Western, you can say, technology was able to be introduced inside, and the other aspects, unwanted aspects, were quite easily thwarted because of the way Islam is, the way monotheism is, the teachings of monotheism, the teachings of Islam and Quran. And the way the Shia Islamic system works is that it wouldn't allow that cultural influence of the West. And now we had a very powerful challenge. And this challenge goes on. And we see that challenge happening today even. And because of that challenge is what we see today, that the Western world and some of the hegemonic powers are, you know, brought to their knees with regards to trying and with regards to trying and controlling Iran. They cannot, because that cultural apparatus that exists within the Iranian society that was inspired by the revolution is so strong that it can buffer the effect of this cultural invasion. And this cultural invasion is a multifold and multifaceted, you can say, attack from these hegemonic powers. It's not just a one-sided attack. It is from all sides. It's, you can say, it's like a hybrid war, which includes a little bit of hard power, but a large amount of soft power. And this needs a very strong, you can say, cultural base to be able to defend it. And luckily, alhamdulillah, this cultural base is there. So we need that. We need to be able to receive that guidance in different times of different parts of our lives, the prophetic guidance to be able to have that steadfastness in the right direction. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The idea that the U.S. democracy is increasingly broken was evidently seen in midterms. Based on an analysis of Federal Election Commission, 465 American billionaires have pumped over $881 million into federal midterm races, with the top 20 donor households giving 73% of the contributions, or collectively more than $643 million. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote, in the U.S., people are often told that the next election is the most important of their lifetimes, or that they should vote like your life depends on it, because it does. Days away from the next midterm elections in the U.S., this month's polls show that motivation to turn out is relatively high among both Democratic and Republican voters, as both sets of party leaders amp up the divisive rhetoric and claim that the opposition has a radically different vision for the nation. Their lives are certainly impacted by and, dare to say, endangered by American policy. Sadly, the state of affairs with what they euphemistically call American democracy means that they, as Americans, simply cannot save themselves through elections. If the goal of American elections is to fulfill democracy, then American elections are dysfunctional. A 2014 study published by Cambridge University Press already classified the U.S. as closer to an oligarchy than to a democracy, saying average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no independent influence in American policymaking. Indeed, the gap between the policies Americans say they want when polled and the policies enacted by their elected representatives widens with each generation. Donald Trump campaigned in 2016 on a promise that he would end American wars, but once in office, continued their imperial violence. Less than 2 years ago, Democrats got behind John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock in Georgia Senate races and promised that Americans helped elect the two and gave Democrats control of the U.S. Senate. They would cut $2,000 COVID relief checks. The nation pitched in. Campaign contributions from all over the nation poured into Georgia on behalf of the Democratic candidates, and the pair were elected. Nearly 2 years later, the main campaign promise, $2,000 COVID relief from Democrats, is still unfulfilled. Both parties' campaign promise specific things if they elect them and when they get elected and placed in sufficient power to deliver on those promises, they simply refuse to do so. Now, they are being asked to give them more power and told that really this time they will give Americans what they promised. They didn't do it in 2021 with the COVID relief checks. Neither party seems very worried about disappointing their base to the point where they get rejected and lose elections. In this venture, capital-styled political system, raising private capital is more essential to the life of a politician or party than winning elections. American voters are being lied to as boldly as ever by politicians, while the opposite of their interests are being pursued by them once in office. The U.S. proxy war against Russia in Ukraine is just the latest and perhaps the most dangerous example. A clear majority of poll Americans say they want the U.S. to pursue direct peace negotiations with Russia. Despite this, both Democrats and Republicans are voting uniformly to give billions more to weapons makers to fuel the violence in Ukraine. And the Biden administration's top diplomat's official policy has been pointedly and proudly not to speak with his Russian counterparts. Americans want their government to negotiate peace, and all the latter has done thus far is help dissuade peace negotiations. If only the lone problem with American elections were that they situated politicians in power who refuse to implement policies voters want. Alas, their elections are more fundamentally fraught than that. Democrats say baselessly that Republicans are under Russian control. Republicans say, without evidence, that Democrats are stealing election victories. Meanwhile, people of color continue to get thrown off voter rolls. They have no national uniformity with voting procedures, which means, among other things, some Americans only have to cross the street to cast a quick vote on election day, while others have to drive miles past police barricades and wait in lines at poorly operating polling centers. U.S. general presidential elections are literally undemocratic because U.S. votes don't count legally. Only those of the several hundred members of their electoral college do. If democracy is the point of American politics is dysfunctional. Democracy is not lucrative, however. Don't be surprised if members of both major parties decide not to include the voters' desires in next year's plans. The money continues to pour into members of both parties, and the big donors contributing to those coffers will continue to wield much more influence over American politics than any non-wealthy voters. In this regard, the website of Truth Out noted, in the current political landscape, fascism is on the rise, and the threat to democracy is imperiled both as an ideal and promise. A number of politicians running for a variety of political offices believe in conspiracy theories, embrace elements of white supremacy, are election deniers, and argue for white Christian nationalism and policies that endorse voter suppression and the banning of books, among other repressive measures. All of these positions should be understood as toxic elements of a rhetoric fueling the neo-fascism embraced by most of the Republican Party, a rhetoric of historical erasure, hate, bigotry, and a politics of disposability. Fascism in the United States is no longer a spiraling improbability, while President Biden claimed in a recent speech that the coming election puts democracy on the block, he vastly underestimates the degree to which the resurgent right wing could soon usher in a fascist politics in the United States. What must not be forgotten is that the politicians advocating these anti-democratic authoritarian positions are not rogue deviants. Rather, they are symptoms of a much wider culture of fascism that condones and normalizes their bigotry and encouragement of violence. They are the new face of a fascist politics. Hunting the U.S. fascist rhetoric is no longer underground in the U.S. It has been awakened and is embraced without apology with the emergence of a new form of brutality. This is a brutality that basks in the language of demagogues, encourages those who trade in lies and ignorance, and manipulate public opinion in the service of tyrants and violence. This rebranded form of fascist politics and its advocates in the coming election share the collapse of conscience reinforced by a form of historical erasure that forgets that their language echoes a history that led to genocide, massive deaths, and assaults on human dignity. This rhetoric exceeds and targets more than any one specific group. It goes far beyond. This rhetoric is now part of a broader language of disposability aimed at migrants, people of color, refugees, and others. What should be condemned here is not only their actions, but also a society that has allowed this fascism to become once again normalized. What should be understood and interrogated in the age of rebranded fascism is the broad-based attack by anti-democratic forces in the Republican Party and their allies on those critical political, cultural, and social institutions that attempt to create informative and critically engaged citizens. The sinister nightmare of a fascist takeover no longer resides in the works of dystopian fiction. It is here in the present, functioning as a lethal fairy tale defined by a contempt for democracy and heralding political doom. The threat of fascism is no longer a matter of speculation. It is about to be put to vote in an election that could transport the unthinkable form, being a provocative fiction, to a cruelly excruciating reality.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we would like to recite for our esteemed listeners a beautiful hadith and tradition which has been narrated from the sixth Imam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. This hadith is about describing Allah with attributes that do not belong to Him, that He does not have. And to be more specific, this is actually one of the conditions or alludes to a condition for the acceptance of supplication and dua. As you know, dua is one of the pillars of Islam. It's very important, but a lot of times our prayers are not answered, and we think, I prayed to Allah, how come my prayers weren't answered? Right, so this indicates that prayers have certain conditions, certain necessary conditions that should be fulfilled in order for them to be answered. Fortunately, these conditions have been mentioned and alluded to in the hadith, and some of them in the Quran as well. One of the conditions is that when we pray to God, right, we shouldn't, in the midst of our prayer, in during our prayer, our supplication, we shouldn't describe God in such a way that is wrong, is incorrect. Like, for example, describing God or alluding to Him as a physical being, right? Or imagining Him as a physical being when praying to Him, right? This is something incorrect, and it kind of cancels out our supplication. It leads to it not being fulfilled. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "A man came to the Commander of the Faithful and said, 'Verily, I have supplicated to Allah, but I have not received an answer.' The Imam alayhi salam said, 'You have described Allah in a manner that He is not worthy of being described. For verily, supplication has four stages: sincerity of the heart, making the intention, having true knowledge of the means, and being fair regarding the request.' So did you supplicate knowing these four conditions?" the Imam says. He says, the person said, "No." Then the Imam said, "Then know them now." Right? So in effect, right, this person who came to the Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, according to this tradition from Imam Sadiq, he said that I prayed to God, but my prayer wasn't answered. And the Imam said that by saying this, right, you have, in effect, described Allah, you have ascribed to Allah certain attributes that He does not have. You're saying, in effect, you're saying that God heard me, but He didn't answer me, right? All, He's unjust, right? He's unjust. I fulfilled all the conditions of, my prayer, and I still wasn't answered, right? This is an incorrect notion regarding God. And it was in the back of your mind, obviously, when you were praying to Him, it just led to your prayer not being accepted. Then the Imam alluded to the stages of supplication that should be passed. First of all, you should have ikhlas and sincerity in your heart. You should have a good intention. You should have true knowledge of the means to acquire what you are requesting. And you should be fair in the request. This person didn't fulfill these conditions, right? He didn't even know them. And, he assumed his prayer wasn't answered. Thus, in effect, he's, ascribing injustice to God, or, that it's something which is unbecoming of Him. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at describing Allah with attributes that do not belong to Him from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala